Floodplain administrator and civil engineer here with us to talk about floodplain regulations, how to work within the system, and what options we have to maneuver and maybe get some more information, flexibility, that type of thing. So please, let's welcome Mr. John Hewitt.
Thank you all for coming. One thing I was going to point out is that I have a consulting firm in Kerrville, and Kerr County hires me as a contract employee to come in once a week and administer their floodplain. And also the city of Ingram does that. So I've been doing that for about 5 years now, so I'm pretty familiar with the regulations. Kerr County and Kendall County, as well as every county in the state, are very similar. There are a few differences, and I'll try to point those out as we go. I'm just going to try to give you a brief overview of the whole program. I don't think you want to know all the nuts and bolts of the federal program. These presentations work best if you just interrupt me right when I get to something that triggers a question. I think that's better than y'all waiting until the end, and I'm comfortable with y'all just interrupting and saying, what about this? So with that, here's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm just going to go briefly over the national program, the flood insurance program, then the implementation for the county, Kendall County here, talk about changes to the floodplain maps, and then get into your questions. The NFIP, National Flood Insurance Program, was started in 1968 to try to regulate flood or construction in the floodplain because they were having lots of flooding back in those days. It was 1968 was the original act. They amended it in 1973. They amended it again in 94. And then Hurricane Katrina and Sandy, those hit 5 years ago or so, those two basically bankrupt the whole system. And so they came out with the Bigger Waters Flood Insurance Act of 2014 to try to change the way that the rates and the financing was done of the program. That was 2012. That's a mistake. 2012 is when they came out with that act. And so what they did is they minimized the government subsidy. They went in and made the property owners kick in a higher portion. So a lot of people were getting letters and notes and contact from the government saying, your rates are going up, and significantly in some cases. Last month, in March, they passed a new, what they call the Homeowner Flood Insurance Affordability Act that rescinded all those rate increases. So they decided that they would go back to the old rates where the government would continue to lose money, but they, and I can't speak to how they have financed that or paid for that. I guess they just borrowed more money. The last number I saw was that the National Flood Insurance Program is $24 billion in the hole. This is, I know you can't read this, but this just goes in and describes what the new act changed last month. One of the questions that I got from Manny, I think it was from Manny or Steve, said that the new 2014 act allows, if the government makes a mistake on your property, that they would refund any costs that you pay to point out that error, which, by the way, the program makes errors all the time, and there's processes to fix those errors. So just because it's on a map in your area doesn't mean it's the gospel truth there. But one of the new changes says that they have lifted the $250,000 limit on the amount that FEMA can spend to reimburse homeowners for successful map appeals based on scientific error. I went ahead, I know I was making this presentation, I called FEMA and said, can you give me some more information on that? The person I spoke to said he's unaware of any time anybody has ever reimbursed a homeowner. So the fact that it's in the law, in the rule, doesn't mean that that's happening. So keep that in mind if you expect to spend money and be reimbursed from the government on that. So the national flood insurance program is administered on a statewide level from the Texas Water Development Board. So they have an office in Austin that procures all those laws and makes sure that all the counties or the local jurisdictions are enforcing the rules correctly and can continue to be in the program. Kendall County is who enforces y'all's law. I'm sure y'all know a lot of this already, but Kendall County is your local NFIP enforcer. The counties get audited occasionally where someone will come back and look at your books to make sure that you're administering the rules correctly. And if you're not, they could theoretically knock you out of the flood insurance program. And you know, the benefits are that if you do have a flood and you're cooperating, you'll get significant support and financial assistance from the federal government in the case of a flood. You may or may not know that.
I have a quick question concerning that. Now, you're saying that the benefits of being a participating county in the NFIP is that we'll get significant support by the federal government or FEMA. Now, what we've been told is that if we're not a participant, then we can't get flood insurance. Is that true?
You cannot get
subsidized.
You cannot get subsidized by the federal government on that. You can still get flood insurance through a private company.
Right, correct.
So you can still get that. That's correct. What I was going to say is Rick Tobolka, and maybe y'all know him, he's the floodplain administrator. My equivalent, I'm the floodplain administrator in Kerr County. He's the Kendall County floodplain administrator. So in 2010, December of 2010, y'all had a new flood insurance study that was done, which redefined your floodplain limits, and I'll get into the definitions, and issued floodplain maps that were adopted in 2010, December 17th of 2010. And there's some information, your community ID number, the name of the flood insurance rate map, and I imagine that most of y'all are familiar with this floodplain map in downtown here. A couple things I'll point out is, when they do these studies, what they do is they go and they figure out how much water is getting to the creeks or the rivers, and then they cut cross-sections, which these little bubbles right here represent cross-sections that were cut across the creek to figure out how deep and fast and wide the water is flowing through those creeks. So there could be lots of changes between here that they don't account for. Hopefully they accounted for any little culverts or road crossings, anything like that. But that's not always the case. The other thing that is interesting on this is these little squiggly lines right here point out what the base flood elevation, which is what they consider that in a 100-year event, how high the water will get. So, for example, I can't read that. That looks like a 1439. That's what they're saying right there is how high the water will get in a 100-year event. Now, the federal government has changed the way they refer to those events, too. They call them a 1% event instead of a 100-year event because some people were getting confused and they thought that we had a flood in 2002, so we won't have another until 2102. That's not the case. You can get three 1% events in 1 year, theoretically. The other thing to note on here is this line right here represents the floodway limits, this cross-hatching, and I'll get into the definition of a floodway here in a few minutes.
I have another quick question concerning that map. What is the light gray area?
Light gray is the 500-year floodplain, which means nothing. I mean, nobody enforces it. It doesn't have anything to do with...
But it may mean something down the road because it's been designated as such.
Yeah.
And it does put you under the purview of federal regulation at that point.
I'm not aware of any kind of regulations with a 500-year. I've heard that there was some discussion of talking about doing some regulations, but I think there would be a huge uproar if they did anything
right.
Like that.
We're standing in that regulatory area right now, which is amazing that they would even put it on the map here on High Street.
Yeah. Okay, so like I said, Kendall County is required to enforce a flood damage prevention order. FEMA gives a guideline to the state, and the state gives these guidelines to each county. And each of the counties are very, very similar, but there's some minor differences from county to county, and I'll go through the whole floodplain prevention ordinance. The first thing I was going to talk about is one of the first things that's addressed in the floodplain ordinance is, what if you decide you don't want to participate in that? What if you just say, I don't care, I'm not getting a permit. Can they do anything about it? In Kerr County, and I guess in Kendall County, the main hammer that we have is that we do not issue a septic tank permit unless you've satisfied the floodplain ordinance. So if you already have your sewer system or your septic tank connected, what else can they do? Well, in Kerr County, and I think this is the same way in Kendall County, is it's considered a Class C misdemeanor if you're in violation of the county permit. And in Kerr County, that would be a $50 fine per day, renewable each day of the continuing violation. So if you were in gross violation and you just said, I don't care, let's just take it to court, in Kerr County, you could come in, let's just say that you were filed against on Monday, that would be a $50 fine for you on Monday. On Tuesday, it would be the $50 on Monday and the $50 on Tuesday. And then you would get written up again on Tuesday for another $50. So that's $150. On Wednesday, it's 50, 50, 50. And you can see how that's going to raise, go up quite a bit. I'm not aware of any time that Kerr County's ever implemented that. And I don't think Kendall County would do that either. I think that Rick would work with you before he got to that point. But there is, in the law, the ability to do that. Definitions, a special flood hazard zone. You might see that definition. That's the same thing as the 100-year floodplain. There's two types of floodplain. There's a Zone A and a Zone AE. Most of Comfort is in Zone AE, which is a defined study with cross-sections through there. On the outskirts of Comfort, you could possibly be in a Zone A floodplain, which a Zone A is for approximate floodplain. And that is very, very approximate, and it's almost always inaccurate, has been my experience. And there's processes to get that Zone A changed. Basically, you have a guy in Washington, D.C. looking at contour maps with 20-foot intervals, and if it's halfway between the 20, just draws a line halfway in there. It doesn't take into account any local changes. So that's why a Zone A is always a very approximate floodplain determination. Base flood elevation, we talked about a little bit, is the 1% chance how high the water will get in that waterway. The regulatory floodway is where the water is flowing highest, deepest, and fastest, and theoretically, local governmental agencies are supposed to keep all development out of the floodway or changes to development out of the floodway.
Can we stop there for a moment since
because
the majority of Comfort is in the floodway?
Correct.
So theoretically, according to the law was intended basically to keep all of Comfort open so that Cypress Creek can drain.
Once they establish the floodway, they establish that floodway based on existing conditions. So they already take into account everything that's already in the floodway. What they're trying to minimize is future changes to the floodway. That's what they're trying to do.
Such as a carport on our property or...
Any and we'll get into those definitions in a minute too. This is the Zone A and the Zone AE, which I was describing to you earlier. I don't think there's anything in here that I didn't point to already on the bigger Yost Comfort map there. Administration, okay. The floodplain administrator is required by the flood insurance program in the state to do these things, which is maintain all your records. Really, any development within the floodplain has to be regulated by that administrator and a permit acquired for that. Two things that the floodplain really, it boils down to two things that the floodplain administrator is trying to do. Any new structures, he wants to be built above that base flood elevation. And also, he wants to minimize development in the floodplain that will raise the base flood elevation upstream.
Doesn't the V or VE, refer to velocity?
V and VE applies to, those zones are coastal floodplain zones. So if you have a V zone, no, not on the maps. If you have a zone V in the map, that refers to the coastal floodplains from the Gulf. No V's around here. Yeah. What was I going to say there? Oh, the analogy I use is if you put any construction or any new fill in the floodplain, what that's equivalent to is when you sit in your bathtub, water level is going to raise. So that's a good way to think of any new development. And that's fine for for your property, but if your downstream neighbor's doing that, that raises the floodplain on your property. And so that's what the floodplain administrator's real responsibility is, to try to minimize that.
What if the federal government does that?
Or the county?
They're supposed to adhere to the same rules, right? In fact, TxDOT is supposed to adhere to these exact same rules that we're adhering to. Is that correct?
That's correct. Now, with that being said, I've seen TxDOT in the past say those don't apply to us. I don't know that they do that anymore, but I know there's a history of that didn't always, wasn't the case. I had personal experience with that. This is just kind of a description of different permits that the floodplain administrator is required to, or different activities that the floodplain administrator is required to issue a permit. And it's all, I know you've seen all this.
Now, in the law, it says any new development, right? So my question, and any new fill, my question, at what point, take a cup of sand, dump it on my property, at what point does it become fill? Can I put a sandbox there? I mean, it seems like a very gray area at where the limit is, which gives a lot of leeway to the floodplain administrator to decide, okay, a doghouse is okay, but a treehouse is not. A carport is okay. If it's above a certain size, we don't know. It's just up to our regulators. Is that correct?
That is correct. Now, when I get into those situations, sometimes I'll call the FEMA representative who's in Denton, Texas. Sometimes I'll call the state and see what they think. For example, recently we had Martin Marietta wanted to excavate gravel mining in the floodplain. Technically, that may or may not be able to get a permit. They're not gonna cause flooding by digging a hole in the floodplain.
That's actually off-site mitigation for somebody.
That's right. It could be. And so I went ahead and called Denton to make sure that was acceptable. So you're right. There's a lot of interpretation by the local floodplain administrator.
And I think that's a lot of our concern, is that there's nothing in black and white that we can follow. It's administrative law where we just call an individual. We might get two different answers depending on who answers the phone.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, the one thing that you can do is, if you hire an engineer to study your situation and submit that information to the floodplain administrator, I mean, when that
more
happens to me,
than a lawyer.
yeah, that's true.
Yes.
Again, what this all boils down to, permit procedures are really boiled down to two things: new structures or substantial improvements to existing structures, which is defined by 50% of more of the existing value of the property. So if you have, let's just make up numbers, you have a $200,000 house and you put a $30,000 addition onto there, that is not considered a substantial improvement.
But you still need a permit for that?
Yes, you still need a permit, but you do not need to adhere to the substantial improvements requirements.
And therefore, the permit should be fairly easily obtained.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a minute, because that's going to get into the... this just tells you what I said before, you know, what the floodplain administrator is expected, how he's supposed to interpret the impact from the permit. Danger to life and property and due to flooding, impacts to your neighbors is really the biggest concern. And again, more expected heights and technical data there. All right, these are the standards that the floodplain administrator is expected to maintain when he reviews the permits. I boil it down into two things. Keep as much as you can above the floodplain level, including electrical, heating, ventilation, plumbing. You want to try to put that above the base flood elevation. And then you can put wastewater systems below the floodplain. I don't know if that's an issue for you all or not, but that's technically acceptable. And then these are the three different types of standards that we have. Residential and non-residential construction, which basically means houses, buildings, commercial developments, is one category. Manufactured homes is a different category, and then RVs is a third category that has different requirements for them. Kerr County, if you go build a house or a building in the floodplain, we require you to be 1 foot above the base flood elevation. Kendall County, I think you can put it at the base flood elevation. So you can be, as long as you're above it at all, it's acceptable.
Now that's in the floodplain.
And floodway too.
And floodway as well.
Yep, both of them. Now what that could cause a problem, because you could be 2 feet below the base flood elevation, and in order to get your house above it, you have to add fill in there. That's going to require what's called a no-rise certificate, where you're going to be required to get a professional engineer to study and see if that fill is going to increase the flood elevation upstream of you. Now, you could also put your structure on piles, like what you'd see along the coast. That'll have less of an impact, and you'll have less, it'll be easier for you to prove that there's no rise upstream. And I'm just going to get into this right now. On that no-rise certificate, there's ways that you can offset that fill. And typically what people do is they excavate, you know, you've added 2 feet of fill, let's say, to get your house out of the floodplain. You can also excavate on your property to mitigate that fill that you put in there. Another thing that a lot of people do is they clean out a very thick vegetation area that blocks the flow. You can go in there and trim that out, and you can get credit for that. Some people will actually, and this gets back to, let's say you put in a gazebo on in your backyard. You could prove that the only thing that's blocking flow are the posts on your gazebo, and you went in and cut down 3 hackberry trees that you have pictures of and document. And you could have an engineer fairly easily prove that there was no net impact for your gazebo.
Yeah, that's
but there's a million options. I mean, what if you want to put a garage in there? Well, now you've blocked the flow for 12 feet, 16 feet, or whatever the width of your garage is. You might have to be a little more creative and cut out a portion of your property to offset that blockage.
Two questions. One, fences. Can we rebuild fences without a permit? Can we replace an old chain link with a new chain link? Or an old chain link with a wooden fence?
Every one of those is unique. First of all, an old chain link with a new chain link. Replacing anything is, yes, you can go ahead and do it. And I'm speaking on behalf of Kerr County at this point. You have an existing chain link fence, you put a new chain link fence in, no problem. I require a permit for that. I require a permit for anything you do in the floodplain, but it's just automatic. I don't have any problem with that. If you're putting in a wood fence that will completely block flow and it's parallel to the direction of flow, that is very easy for me to approve. No problem. Now you're putting in a 6-foot wood fence perpendicular to the flow, I think that will block flow and cause problems for your upstream neighbors. So I would want to see some sort of analysis showing that you're not going to cause flooding.
And then secondly, flood shadow. We hear nothing about flood shadow. If I have a 180-foot wide building and I want to put a 5-foot wide porch on the downstream side of that, is that a fairly easy thing to do?
You're not going to obstruct flow with that. In the shadow of an existing structure or building, you're not going to obstruct flow. What you are going to do is you're going to add fill, like I said, when you sit in a bathtub. So that there is an impact with that. Now, a small building is going to have a very minimal. I mean, you think about the floodway, and I'm just making up numbers, 2,000 feet wide, 12 feet deep. That's a lot of volume. If you're putting in a 10-foot wide structure, 2 feet deep, that's a minimal impact.
But the no rise is, now in engineering terms, no rise still gives you a leeway of 0.1 inches or something like that. Is that correct, or is it literally zero?
I'll speak to Kerr County. In Kerr County, if you're in the floodway, it's 0.00 feet.
So 0.00. So theoretically, that cup of fill is a rise and would have to be offset.
But I get engineers that submit reports to me that say, This is a 0.04% of the floodplain. I'll go cut down a tree
And offset this.
Yeah. So there's ways to use common sense on this.
Now, not to point at my situation over and over, but I built a carport with no flooring whatsoever.
Did it have walls on it?
No.
So you just had posts?
I just had posts. And it is in the shadow of fences, and I mean, it's in the middle of my property, surrounded by other neighbors. But I still have to show some kind of offset there, which what I ended up doing, and Mr. DeBolt was kind of to work, we took down a fence in the middle of other fences.
Yeah, that's a good example.
But at some point, you have to look at it. I figured out you can't apply logic to this, because if it's surrounded by fences, and you take down something in the middle, there's no impedance being removed from that situation. And it's like taking down the interior wall of my home.
Yeah, and that situation is more of a fill in the floodplain, removing the storage of the floodplain then flow through the river. Mm-hmm. That's the bigger concern in that situation.
Okay.
How about if you want to build a $1,000 building, why do you need a $10,000 engineer? Why can't they go straight to you and say, this is what I got, this is what it is, you need a little common sense?
That's a good question, because there's liability issues in that. And so the county engineer doesn't want to be responsible from a liability standpoint. But what I tell you is that shouldn't be a $10,000 study.
Yeah. Should be a half area beam on it.
And, I mean, there's several engineers. A typical type of situation that you're describing should be in the $1,000 to $3,000 range.
Well, $1,000 building is kind of
dumb. That's 200-300% increase to the cost of your structure. What about variances? We don't talk about variances very often. One of the reasons for a variance is an exorbitantly high requirement, cost-wise, to an inexpensive project. So if you have a $1,000 building and you want to get a variance, one of the routes for a variance is that I have to spend a lot of money to get this small project done. Have you ever been involved in the issuance of a variance?
There's been one variance that I'm aware of in Kirk County, and what happened there was someone built the property, or made the improvements, and then came back and was subject to fines, and it went through commissioner's court to grant that variance. Kirk County, I don't know that I could just issue a variance without the county attorney and the county commissioners being involved.
Correct. They have to be involved. It goes through them. One of my concerns early on when I investigated variances, well, who do we appeal to if we don't like this result? Well, we appeal back to the floodplain administrator. Well, that's circular appeal. That can't be right. So it goes through the commissioner court at that point, and they make a vote. If the requirements are met for the variance, then it can be applied.
Yes, that's what the variance procedure is for. It's for the commissioners, the county attorney, and the county floodplain administrator to decide and talk about that.
Right. Following the flood of 2002, they implemented this law, or really came down and looked at it, revisited it, and the historical foundation said, well, if your property is deemed historical, then all you need to do is go talk to the county and get a variance, and you have a letter from us, and you can continue maintaining your property and improving it. Since then, no one knows that conversation ever took place, but I have a newspaper article where the floodplain administrator at the time said as much.
And so the historical building would have a historical designation. There's two or three requirements for it to be considered to be a historic building. And the main thing that helps is that you can add on to your building below the floodplain level. Because if you were going to add on to your building, you would come under the substantial improvements category. But if you're a historic structure, you can go ahead and add on to your building below the floodplain level.
Right.
Still have to demonstrate that there's no rise associated with those improvements, even though it's a historical structure.
Right. And you're not limited to 50%.
Correct. That goes away. That's right. That's the...
So that's one grounds for variance. What are other grounds for variances?
I think the exceptional cost as it relates to the actual project was one.
Let me just read what it says on variances here. Variances will not be issued within any designated floodway if any increase at all in the flood level will result. So that's a problem.
Right. Well, they're saying that it has to be proven no rise, period.
Yeah.
Which seems pretty all-encompassing. I mean, no variance whatsoever, ever, if there's any kind of rise. Which eliminates all utility, which eliminates any TxDOT projects without off-site mitigation.
Well, I mean, a utility project's going to be underground. That shouldn't have much of a...
Well, telephone poles and that kind of thing. I mean, I'm sure the utility company owes the county millions of dollars for undocumented telephone poles and things like that.
Again, that should be pretty easy to mitigate, just like the post for a gazebo or a post for a garage or a covered structure.
But they're supposed to get a permit for each one.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. Even a cell phone tower, for example. Specifically standards, and we've kind of talked about this, you can build an enclosure below the floodplain level as long as you show no rise and you have these items satisfied. They want to have an opening on either side of the building so the flow can go through there, and there's a formula here. The openings can only be a foot above the grade, and then there's a certain formula for how many vents you have to put in there, and that's not included in this.
It's like 2 inches for every 12 inches or something like that.
There's a criteria for that.
But for these projects in the floodway, all we need is a no-rise certificate, technically?
Well, for what? For
If we were to build that enclosed structure with the openings and...
As long as you satisfy the enclosure criteria, yes, then a no-rise would be...
No-rise would be sufficient. But I think in our regulations it says an H&H study.
Same thing. An H&H study is the same thing as a no-rise study, and there's different levels depending on what you're putting in and what you're doing. Like I was saying, I mean, if you're just putting in a $1,000 building, you could be looking at a $1,000 to $4,000 study. If you're doing all kinds of improvements on your property, it could be $5,000 to $6,000. Just depends. We talked about floodways. This is a graphical representation. You might not care how they do it in the model, but basically, here's your floodplain to this limit. They have these hydraulic models that they've generated that comes up with that floodplain. They start pushing in until they raise the water surface 1 foot. So that's how a floodway gets determined. Is in that model, they just start pushing over. And in the case of Comfort, they didn't have to push very far at all before they got a 1 foot rise. So that's why your floodplains are very, very small compared to your floodway out here. Every situation is unique. And it depends on the depth of the channel and the width of the floodplain and slope, a lot of different factors. But the bottom line is, in Comfort, Texas, the floodplain is very much, or almost the same as the floodway. And that just, that's...
It seems like there's much need for a county engineer if you have to hire an engineer to do anything. It's like you're double paying here.
The county engineer is making sure that the private engineers are doing their job. This is just what I was talking about before. If you fill in the floodplain, the net increase is that you raise the water surface, and you know this house wasn't in the floodplain, now it is. Okay, so if the floodplain map is wrong, which it is all the time, you have several different processes to go through. Especially in Comfort, my understanding is that there's a lot of homes that are in the, or businesses that are in, shown in the floodway or floodplain that is wrong. You can fill out what's called a letter of map amendment that is free and submit it to the government and have them send you a letter back and say, you're correct, we're removing your structure out of the floodplain. That letter, you can do one of two things. You can remove a house or a structure or multiple structures on your property, or you can remove a portion of your property by meets and bounds from a surveyor. And then FEMA will send you back a letter that says, We agree, this is official, you're out of the floodplain, and the insurance companies will recognize that. It's free to do that. You can get all the documents online. What we see a lot of times, all they're going to do is two things. They're going to look at the base flood elevation and compare that to your house. And they're going to look at two things on your house, the finished floor elevation and what's called the lowest adjacent ground next to your house, what's called the lag. And if you're on a slope, they're going to take the shallower lag. And they're going to compare the lag elevation with the base flood elevation. And if the lag is higher, you get a letter back from the government saying you're out of the floodplain. Simple as that. Free, free to do that. You'll have to have surveyors involved in that. And what I've seen is the survey costs anywhere from $300 to $600 to do that. And lots of times they do an elevation certificate is what they would give you.
So the forms are free, but to get the actual document from FEMA, you got to go pay for a survey. Is that correct?
Well, the FEMA has to have somebody certify that your house or your lag is above the base flood elevation.
They can't do it off the topo?
The topo information they have is what they used already to develop that.
That's what you're proving is accurate.
They put you in there with that, they won't take you out with that?
Absolutely, and I think that's wrong. I mean, that's a general problem I have, is that they can incorrectly put you in a floodplain and say, okay, now you pay this money unless you can prove otherwise.
It's at your expense to prove them wrong, and there's no reimbursement.
I see in the law that there's reimbursement, but nobody knows of that ever occurring.
Yeah.
And I can't advocate or speak on behalf of the government because I would have never made those rules. That's crazy. And it happens all the time. What's even worse is people that are in rural areas have an A zone. There is no base flood elevation. At least in Comfort, you can go in and you can point to the map and say, look, my base flood elevation is 1439. If you're in an A zone, there's nothing to find. And so, historically, FEMA has made you pay an engineer to determine what the BFE was out there. Now, what Kirk County does is we just send the application into FEMA and say, you told us that we're in a floodplain, you tell us what the BFE is. And that's been working. So that's saved homeowners and property owners thousands of dollars right there, too.
They say what the BFE is.
Well, I switched over to an A zone where they don't tell you where the BFE is. So if you're in an A zone, which might be... But not in downtown Comfort. You have to actually figure out what the base flood elevation is and your finished floor elevation to get that.
But if you just send them a general letter contesting it, they'll usually just say, never mind. Kind of thing. That's what has been.
What we're doing now in Kirk County, and I'm, as a floodplain administrator, I'm helping. Well, I mean, I'll get an 80-year-old lady that's never been in a floodplain, and she gets a letter that says, okay, your rates are going up from 500 or up to 500 a month or some ridiculous amount. She'll have to pay for the elevation certificate, which might be $400, and it'll say that her lowest adjacent ground next to her house is at, make up a number, 1600. We won't make her figure out what the base flood elevation 100 years is. We'll send it off to FEMA and say, y'all tell us what the base flood
elevation
is.
Because figuring out what your base flood elevation can run up to $40,000 to $150,000.
No, it would be $2,000 to $3,000 for an engineer.
To figure out the base flood elevation.
Yeah, because an engineer has to figure out what the drainage area is, the watershed area, and then figure out how much water is getting there, cut some cross sections, and figure out the width and the depth of the flow in at that property. So we put that back on the government. We've had good luck with that. So the government will not charge you to review that application for a LOMA, letter of map amendment. A letter of map revision is different. They will charge you to review that, and that's a bigger situation where you might have your property shown in the floodplain, but you want to put in a retaining wall or any structural changes. You want to put in culverts, you want to pave over a parking lot and put some drainage culverts underneath there. That's called the letter of map revision. And there's lots of little acronyms that they have in here. They will charge you $5,000 to review that and make sure that your changes are okay. I don't see a lot of those because people aren't willing to spend money to pay the engineer and pay the government to review.
That's usually a community that does that, like Kerrville did to get some changes to their actual map. The letter of map revision actually changes the map. The other one is just a letter attached to your deed for
exactly.
your particular property.
That's exactly right. Now, the other thing is, if you want to develop a piece of property and you want to sell that to somebody and you want to show that this could be removed from the floodplain, and I don't know if anybody has that situation, there's two different processes for that. There's a LOMAR, but there's actually a CLOMAR, conditional letter of map revision. And what that is you send it in, the government says, I haven't done this, but this is what I want to do. I want you to approve this before I make these changes. Because historically, what would happen is people would make these changes, the government would say, yeah, go ahead and do it. They'd make the changes, and the government would come back and say, well, you can't do that. So they added what's called a conditional letter of map revision so that you'll have something on file that says, I did this like we agreed that I would do. Now you need to approve it. So
I think I've seen that with development properties around lakes, things like that. They sell the raw land, and they have a CLOMAR saying that if you buy this land, you will be able to do this with this land.
So if you had property and you wanted to put a retaining wall and remove part of your property out of that floodplain, you would have to fill out a LOMAR to do that. There's also a LOMAR-F, which means I just want to add fill on my property and remove it out of the floodplain by doing that. And you can get a document from FEMA saying, okay, you're out of the floodplain now by doing that. As a part of that, you have to do the no-ride certificate also to show that you're not flooding anybody. But that can be done.
What about off-site mitigation? If you have a property downstream or upstream, and you mitigate on that property, it can then apply to your in-town property, is that correct?
It depends where your off-site mitigation is occurring. Do you impact anybody between the off-site and the on-site mitigation? I mean, if your off-site is lowering the water surface everywhere, yes, you can
Wonderful.
Do that.
Yeah. And can that be transitioned from one entity to another? In other words, if the county has, how would you measure it? Cubic feet per second or?
Cubic yards. Well, I mean, here's a typical thing that is done with that, is you have all these properties that are in the floodplain. You go upstream of all this and you divert the flood flows out of that creek into a little, what's called a detention pond, let the water sit there until the flood passes, and then you bleed it back out later.
Right.
That's how you can remove properties out of the floodplain by doing that. And so that's off-site mitigation right there.
Which brings us to the proposal of a water storage or water supply facility upstream and on Cypress Creek that Jonathan Letts and the organization of, or the committee of members that signed the MOU to work together on Cypress Creek for either an ASR, water retention, or to pipe water from Canyon Lake. If they did build an ASR or water retention facility on Cypress Creek, would that by definition alter our flood maps?
No.
Even though logically it does alter the flow.
Well, here's the thing. You have to have the creek hydraulically connected to that storage area. What, in order to get the benefits. If you have a big hole in the ground, but the creek doesn't get to that hole in the ground, it's just going to keep flowing on by.
Right. Well, this would be a dam that diverts water for water supply and possibly an actual reservoir if that's what's deemed feasible.
Okay, and the problem with that is that in the water supply reservoirs, they want to keep that full to the top so that they have water available. In the flooding situation, you want no water in there at all so that when the flood comes, you can fill it up. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have two separate holes in the ground right next to each other. One of them is full and one of them is empty that you dump water into.
An ASR, isn't the point of an ASR to keep it empty because you're pumping it back into the aquifer? You capture it when you have plenty and you pump it back into the aquifer to keep it low, and then it would be a dual-purpose structure.
The ASR is different times of the year. You want it full. In the summer, you want to use all the water you can. In the winter, you want to have it full, filling up the well downstream, I mean down in the hole. Mm-hmm. So that depends on different times of the year.
We have thousands of dams in Texas, 2,000 and some odd dams in Texas. Many of them are dual-purpose structures. So it would behoove us to advocate for a dual-purpose structure if we're going to build something, because Lord knows we're not going to get two. So we won't get another chance down the road. And we're in the process of performing that feasibility study right now with over $100,000 of grant money from the Texas Water Development Board now to study the second.
My understanding is that's purely water supply, though. I don't think that's flood protection.
Right.
There are flood protection grants, and I know that the Kendall County has investigated that the state will pay half of.
Right.
So there's ways for the state to pay for the county to do that.
And if we can get that ball rolling, we might be able to combine these two endeavors and end up with a dual-purpose structure.
That's correct.
Which then, finally, we would see the benefits of, much like Bernie has. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the flood maps of Bernie, but Cibolo Creek, which is larger than Cypress Creek, has a floodway that only extends about 15 feet from the banks of the stream.
The Comfort's unique in that you have the Guadalupe River and Cypress Creek come together. So it's possible that you could divert every drop of water upstream of Cypress Creek and you'll just have a little trickle coming down in a 100-year event down Cypress Creek, but the Guadalupe River will be so high that it'll back up in the Cypress Creek.
But we lose our velocity rating at that point, which might create more floodplain as opposed to floodway.
Well, you'll still have a floodplain that could back up from the Guadalupe River. That's something that has to be looked at, and I don't know how that relationship between that is. But I'm just telling you that don't feel like if you diverted all the water out of Cypress Creek, that solves all your problems. You also have to see if the Guadalupe River, and you mentioned to me, it could get backed up at the high bridge. The whole thing could be 8 feet higher, backing up into Cypress Creek by doing that.
Right.
So.
But typically the flooding is because both of them are coming in.
Only when both of them are coming in, yeah.
Do
we
get
it?
Yeah,
and usually it is.
You get flooding from both, is usually the situation.
And usually it's because of backing up. We have a lake situation. A dam and lake situation, it seems like, which for the floodway designation, I was under the impression we had to have significant velocity. I think a lot of us could deal with floodplain regulations. It's when we're regulated the same as if we tried to build in the middle of the creek. You know, the regulations are the same as if we tried to build a house in the creek that baffles us.
Let me see if I can clarify that, because the floodway is defined generally is where the water's flowing deeper, faster, all that. But the floodway is put on a map based on pushing in the limits to that point. So it's not necessarily extremely high velocities in the floodway. That's not always the case. So you could be backed up from the Guadalupe River just stagnant lake, and that could be considered a floodway, even if the velocities are very small. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So, I guess let's just take questions. I don't know if I need to summarize that. It'd probably be best to get into specific questions.
You have any questions?
Yes.
The Cypress Creek flowing into Comfort, the bed in the last 20 years has risen considerably. It's blocked up with debris and trees and branches. Whose responsibility is it to keep that creek flowing?
Would that be county or
TxDOT? That's a tough question, because if you go in and you start, let's just say somebody went in with a backhoe from the county and dug that out to make it better. The first thing that's going to happen is the Parks and Wildlife Department are going to come screaming that you've impacted the salamander or whatever. So you have to get the Parks and Wildlife in the state think they own the river. So I think that's a state responsibility more than a county responsibility. Like, I mean, I know that if you were to go back your pickup and go scoop gravel out and fill your pickup up, you would get a fine from the state for taking their gravel. So I don't think the county can legally go in there and clean out the ditch. But what you're saying is exactly right. That makes it even worse. You've got these dead trees in there. It's blocking stuff, and that makes the whole situation.
The water does not flow under the bridge anymore. Just, well, very little.
Now, if it's a bridge crossing, I think you could go in and say, if you own that bridge, like TxDOT or whoever, y'all need to clean out your bridge, your block and flow through here.
TxDOT.
Yeah.
We have any other questions?
One other thing that the county administrator is required to, when he reviews a permit, he has to make sure that the TCEQ is notified and the Parks and Wildlife, and if it's a big enough project, the Corps of Engineers. But most of y'all's projects aren't going to be big enough that the Corps needs to be involved. But let's just say you want to go in and clean up your banks. You know, you've got all these dead trees in there. Technically, you need a permit to do that. And sometimes TCEQ, all they care about is that you're not going to divert water out of the river onto your property. That's all they care about. Water rights is their interest. Parks and Wildlife is interested in animals and fish and that kind of stuff. But that's a part of the permit application, is that the Parks and Wildlife and TCEQ aren't affected or don't have concerns.
Pretty much it comes down to anything in the floodway requires a no-rise certificate. Anything in the floodway that's performed requires an engineer to write that letter.
And what I want to emphasize is just because it requires a no-rise does not mean that that's a $10,000 study. Did you pay for a study when you went and reduced?
I paid for an engineering letter, then Mr. Kubalka returned with his engineering hat on, and we looked at some mitigation options as far as removing the fence, removing the structure.
In those type of situations, I think your best process is to talk to the commissioners and have the commissioners talk and decide with the floodplain administrator.
So some of these obvious items, like the $1,000 structure, we might be able to work directly without doing these technical studies in some cases.
And I would say possibly.
Right, now
that's,
right.
That's
you're not our floodplain administrator, it's hard to say for sure.
That's possible.
But I can say that it did happen once in my case. I had to remove a 35-foot section of fence to put up a cardboard in the shadow of my home. So there are options here, but none of them are legislated. The regulations seem very gray, so we have to work within those gray areas.
Let me tell you this. I think that those regulations are black and white, and if you called Washington, D.C., they would say, absolutely not, there's no way we'll budge on this. I think the local administrators are the ones that are kind of trying to work because they're neighbors, and
right.
So we're trying to help guys out.
But as far as the black and white thing, there is no definition of when that cup of sand becomes filled, right?
I think if you called Washington, D.C., they'd say
they
a cup of sand, that's not acceptable.
Gotcha. Now, as far as the no-rise certificate, what are we looking at if you want to build a $1,000 structure? You're saying $1,000 to $4,000 to get that no-rise certificate?
Of course, it all depends on where you're located. For example, I've helped... Phil's name, right down there where he used to have Phil's firehouse.
Phil Jenkins,
yeah. And all Phil did is he cut some areas, cut some trees, and moved some dirt over in some other areas. And that was, I don't remember the exact, it was less than $2,000. But, I mean, that's a very straightforward, there was no hydraulic modeling, it wasn't a $5,000 study, it was real straightforward on that.
So I think it's encouraging for us to hear that there are ways to do this that's under the $40,000 number that gets thrown at us when, you can't do this, there's no way it can happen, and you're looking at some kind of study you've never heard of before from a limited quantity of engineers available, and a lot of us get scared away by that.
Yeah.
But these things can be done, and there are a lot of ways to do them. We just have to speak with an engineer.
Yeah, there's a lot of different options, too. I mean, again, you could, if you put your house... I mean, you're right. It's a bad idea to build in the floodway if the floodway is correct. First of all, it's bad to build in the floodway. I think there's errors in your floodway. I mean, I think, I know that there's some surveying mistakes that have been done in here, and I don't know.
There are also a lot of historic properties, though, and in that case, it's good to maintain your property, even if it's in the floodway. We have homes that are over 100 years old. The fifth oldest bowling alley in Texas, Bill's Firehouse, is one of the closest structures to the water course. Yet it's been here all that time. without being washed away.
Right, and that's good evidence that there's mistakes in coverage floodplain determination.
If we could briefly revisit the historical exemption, when Steve went and met with you, I sent the historical records, I think federal historical records, talking about comfort. Now, what Rick Tobolka wants to see when he comes to your home is a plaque.
Right, and that's technically for the requirements, is that it's a that particular structure is designated on a register. That's what the rules read.
Now, when our floodplain administrator in 2002 gave the interview, that was not the case. We needed a letter from the Historical Society, as well as, which means it's individually recognized by a recognized entity, and then we needed to be included in the register as a community, which applied a year and an area.
And so, again, that will allow you to build your structure below the floodplain, but you still have to do a no-rise with that addition
right.
on there.
Right. But we're not in danger of being told we can no longer repair our home. Because if we have a fire, and to repair that it's over 50%, we are forced to demolish our property at that point, or abandon it. Because you're not allowed to do over 50% reconstruction. And that was the whole point, I think, of the exemption for the historical properties, is that you should have no fear of having to walk away from your home. You will be able to repair it. It seems like a lot of people are real unsure on how that historical designation is accepted or applied, or, you know, am I a historic property?
What I would tell you on that is I think the rules say that it has to be an individually designated structure on a register, but you've got someone that interpreted that to be the whole downtown, and I would follow up on that and try to get something in writing saying that this qualifies. And if you had that from FEMA, I mean, if you had that from the National Historic Register area, and you could take that to FEMA and get the variances that you're looking for.
Right.
Yeah, one more question. Are you familiar with the school in Comfort?
No.
Well, they're up higher than the land below, and they have paved a great deal of the land around them, and the water is channeled down the hill, not in a pipe. It just flows over private property, and when it gets to Main Street and Third Street, because of the water, which should naturally go down to the creek, has been diverted, and it causes a lot of flooding at that point. Whose responsibility is it to either pipe that water or take it somewhere where it should go, rather than just flood an area around town?
The school district, whoever made those changes. So when they made those changes, when they did that, they hired an engineer to evaluate the impact of that paving. And typically, that's the purpose of detention ponds, is to detain the difference between the existing runoff and the proposed runoff, because when you pave over something like that, it doesn't infiltrate into the ground. It runs off, and more water typically runs off. And so that engineer that worked for the school district, as a part of his design, evaluated that directly.
So if they were not in the floodplain, they wouldn't have had to have gotten a permit?
Not a permit, but they still are obligated to make sure that they don't cause additional runoff on their downstream neighbors.
Who are they obligated to?
Well, let's see, you don't have a city, so... that's a tough one, because
there's no
then you're getting into the lawyers, because you can't adversely impact your neighbor. You can't just point a runoff into it towards his house or something. So, but then that's a civil lawsuit, and then the lawyers are involved. And I've seen that before, and that gets expensive.
Now, the 500-year floodplain that really shouldn't apply to anything, but is designated. Are there permits required in there?
No.
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 In no circumstances.
I'm not aware of any circumstance that you need a permit in a 500-year floodplain.
John, I think she has a question.
Yes, ma'am.
John, I have a question. Okay, I have a kind of unique situation. I live in an over 90-year-old house down on the border, 50 water. My husband is a homebound wounded warrior.
The VA is insisting that we modify this, get more room and modify this house. They did a feasibility study. You can't modify that house. We have to add on. He can't be on stilts. So basically, is that my variance? My house is historical.
What is it that you want to add on to the house?
We have to have him a bedroom with a handicap bath, accessible from the bedroom, and a couple of other things. They've already, the VA has already approved the house plans that I had the architect draw. Is that my variance?
That's, there's a lot of different things. That's potential variance. Now, you'd have to look at a lot of different things. Is there somebody immediately upstream of you that...
Lisa.
Me?
Well, I mean...
She's surrounded by homes. And that's something else that I noticed. There was some wording regulations about being surrounded by other properties. At some point, adding a little bit...
My house is up a bit anyway. I'm not on stilts, but my house has never taken any water even in the basement. I mean, just be attached to my house with three stores all over the room. You just open the doors and the water can flow through it.
Well, the easy answer is that would be probably not a variance. But I would say if all your neighbors around knew that you were going to raise the water surface by a little bit, I don't know. That's a hard one.
I mean, is it government against government? Is it government against government? I mean,
oh, absolutely. That happens all the time.
We're seeing that at the Comfort Park.
Go
we
there.
Put in Jungle Gym because we need an H&H study and no RISE certificate. Just put in some Jungle Gyms down at the park.
If you're adding one bedroom and one ramp, for example, I mean, I think you could mitigate that. I think you could show that there's, well, every situation is unique. I don't know if water is really slow moving through there or fast moving through there or...
I think
so. But if I went to them, I think I would go in there with as much information as you could go in there with and say, look.
Plus, I'm in a historical thing. Plus, it's less than 50%. The addition is less than 50% of the.
So that's good.
I mean, it's right at 50% of the value of the house.
I know that.
You still have to show the no rise, right?
What's that?
The no rise.
But you could pop, I mean, there's ways to show that no rise. And if it's, it depends on if you're building perpendicular to the flow or parallel to the flow, and if you're in the shadow of some other structure, there's a lot of different
things. I'm in the shadow of my house.
And all of us. She's surrounded by other structures.
So what that would mean is I don't think that flow would get blocked by your construction.
No, it won't.
So then you're simply talking about when you fill in the floodplain, that there's less storage in the floodplain than there used to be. Now, maybe you get in, you get a backhoe and you cut out a foot along a part of your property. I don't know, there's just different ways to do that.
Now, if the county acquires some credits, because you can cut down a tree and record, I cut down a tree and use it later, is that correct? Or I remove a structure and record that and use it later. If the county removes, say, the bleachers at the football field in the floodway and records that, can they then parcel that out when someone comes and appeals to the commissioner's court?
Yeah. Theoretically, that makes sense.
I think the commissioner's court would be more than happy in situations like these, a wounded veteran, you know, to give them 8 cubic feet of offset and parcel that out on a community level. Is that?
Yeah, that's possible. That makes sense. That's logical, and I think that...
You said to keep records of that, right?
Yeah.
How do we keep records of that?
Photographs.
Yeah.
But I mean, it has to go somewhere. Someone has to keep that. Or would that be the
floodplain administrator?
Would that be Rick?
I get, in Kerr County, yeah, I get people that will come in and say, hey, I think my neighbor cut down some trees 4 or 5 years ago. That isn't going to cut it. That's not good enough.
What about our football bleachers? Because those were removed about 3 years ago, and we have a lot of documentation, videotaped football games, that they were there. Could that be retroactively claimed?
How high up do the... Were the bleachers were in the floodway?
Two stories. They were in the floodway. Everything is in the floodway.
Yeah, possibly.
That might be around the chicken.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, I think you're going to have to get, I think the floodplain administrator will say, show me the person that's going to take responsibility for taking credit for those bleachers.
Which would be the county.
I think your county administrator is going to make you have an engineer sign and seal that document that's going to say there's no rise because we took out these
bleachers. We have a county engineer. Shouldn't that be something simple for the county engineer to... That's not an out-of-line request for our county engineer, since the county is the one that removed the bleachers and that sort of thing. Or maybe it's the school.
Why do you have to have two engineers for liability? Why? I don't understand.
Let me think about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to be hired and you accept it, and we have an engineer, and the county has liability insurance, why would we have double lights?
I need to check on that. I hear what you're saying. That makes sense. You're paying for the county engineer already.
And we have insurance
that serves the county.
That's right. Why would we have to do it twice?
Yes.
And I'm just making this up as I go. It's because the county believes that someone needs to make sure it's done correctly. So you don't want your county engineer checking his own work, for example. For example, I can't do any work in Kerr County because I have to check and make sure that it was done correctly as interpreted by the county and the state and the federal government.
When we went and spoke with our county engineer here, he said, it's not my business, I'm out of it entirely. That didn't sound like he was overseeing anything or any kind of oversight. It sounded like our floodplain administrator at Carte Blanche.
What I can tell you is that when people call me in Kerr County, will you approve this? I can't have them pay me to approve it because I have to, or to design it, I have to approve what they come up with. Yeah.
So really, our questions as to what is required aside from a plaque, because nowhere in the regulations have I seen you need a plaque. We really have to question FEMA. Contact them and get a straight answer on what the FEMA representative told us if he was lying.
And there's 1-800 numbers that you can call if they, I mean, I call them a lot with specific questions, and there's always someone there that will answer those.
Yeah, I'll move back.
Okay.
Okay.
What about statute of limitations? If somebody violated the rules 10 years ago, can they stop considering themselves a criminal because they built that shed 10 years ago without a permit? At what point are they no longer criminals?
I don't know.
The federal government. None of these people.
Where is that?
I mean, when I dump that cup of fill, at what point am I not going to be prosecuted?
I would say that the maps were done in 2010, and theoretically they included everything that was done up to that point. So if you were in before the maps were created, I think you're covered. After the maps, I think I think you're liable until the next maps come out.
Right. So they reset the ticker when they reissued those maps.
Yeah. And remember, you can... There's state money available to go in there and do a planning study and identify areas that have been studied incorrectly in here. Mm-hmm. And they'll give you that money. If you can prove that you have a certain dollar amount of economic liability at stake or it's hampering future development because of these incorrect maps, they'll go in, they'll kick money, and they'll prioritize all the people that apply across the state for this state money and federal money.
To get a little more.
To go in and restudy, to do these planning grants to revise the existing floodplain maps. And that's really your best bet because I think that there's some errors in your existing maps that show too much area in the floodway and floodplain.
Right. And what's our first step to do that? Is it call FEMA again? Because they know nothing about any money being given to anyone.
The way it works is that the state has planning grants that all the communities across the state apply for. And so your community has to apply for one of those grants.
So it's a grant through the Texas Water Development Board.
Exactly.
At a county level. Our county would apply for those grants.
Correct. That's right. And then the state would pay 50% of that cost. Cost might be $80,000, it might be $100,000. State will kick in half. The county can get credit for creating maps, or I mean, they don't have to put the full dollar amount out there. They can get credit for in-kind work as a part of that too.
Ken, you might be able to correct me on this, but I believe the county owns quite a bit of property in the floodway area down in the Flats. Is that correct?
We own several lots. Yes.
Right. So if it costs $80,000 to get 50% of those lots removed from the floodway, suddenly each one of those lots is worth upwards of $130,000 or so? $80,000 for a lot that's not in the floodway?
But if you're in the floodway, you're still in the floodway.
But not if we revise our maps. See, if the maps get changed and those properties are removed from the floodway, then they're viable pieces of property that suddenly the county owns.
The lots that we have here
are definitely in the floodway.
Given to us by FEMA, because they bought the property and then FEMA gave us the lots, and so there's nothing to be built on.
And my point is, if we re-engineer our maps and it turns out they are not legitimately in the floodway, then they're no longer regulated, and the county can pay for the study with the property.
When the creek comes up and the river comes up, they are in the floodway.
Yeah, yeah. We don't know any a little further up. They're all in the
floodway. We don't know anything out of the floodway.
Right.
Well, what's your point?
My point is that we can change the floodway boundaries, and then suddenly they might not be. They might be in the floodplain as opposed to the floodway. If the engineering study proves that the floodway boundaries are incorrect, which we all know they are, therefore some of these properties are viable and might pay for the study.
Oh, study. That's
all.
So another question. What about all the debris in an area like junk cars and buildings that aren't being lived in and all kinds of junk that's in the floodplain and floodway?
That makes it worse, absolutely.
I mean, this area that Manny's talking about, the last time we had a big flood, there were cars floating across and the whole lot.
So we remove them, we take a picture, and we apply that as a community to individual properties or community properties.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what kind of debris you're talking about, too. Very clearly, if you have overgrown vegetation and dead trees blocking flow, and you clear that out, there's an improvement. You should be getting some credit for that.
It's interesting because that's the type of thing that'll grow back in 10 years, and we can get
and the next
credit.
Flood, it'll dump it
more
in.
Credit.
In.
More credit. Hackberries, real quick. You're gonna see a lot of hackberry farms. Well, any more questions? I think you've been very informative. Let's all give John a round of applause. Good to get some answers to some of these questions. And do you have any cards with you?
Yes.
Visit with John after the meeting and get a card if you'd like some more information. I'd like to present you with a Cover Floodplain Coalition hat. Wear them with pride. Anytime you come see us.